Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE Presents. This week, join the revolution with Hi-C as we explore what it means to be in love. Our revolutionary guest this month is Sarah Astarte, PhD. Sarah is a transpersonal psychologist whose practice includes spiritual guidance, creative expression, dream interpretation, channeling, and shamanic healing techniques. We'll be talking about her book, The Lover Within, exploring the relationship between body image in adult women and the archetypes of the lover, as well as the extensive research she has done on the topic of love, sexuality, and body image. Our monthly astrology outlook with James Moran will be joined by a new monthly segment, Living Well with Linda, offering you natural alternatives to staying healthy in body, mind, and spirit, presented by Linda Wiley. Plus, call in at 646-716-5510 for the opportunity to receive on-air readings. Love comes in many voices as we hear different perspectives on what it means to be in love. Today's roundtable topic with Hi-C is forgiveness, coming right up.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. We are once again here with our revolution on a Sunday morning, and I'm really looking forward to the show today. I think you'll be interested in hearing what some different people have to say about what it means to be in love throughout the show. And then our featured guest interview today, Sarah Astarte, I think you're going to find really interesting. And we're going to be talking about some things that everybody, two things that everybody loves to talk about, maybe one thing that people don't like to talk about, but love, sexuality, I mean, who doesn't want to talk about love and sex, and body image. So stay tuned for that, and I think you'll really like that, and I'm looking forward to that a little later in the show. As you heard in the intro, we're also introducing a new monthly segment today called Living Well with Linda. And that will be giving you some natural alternatives that you can use to stay healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And that will be brought to us each month by Linda Wiley, who is a food therapist, among other things, up in Eugene, Oregon. We'll be starting our show as we normally do with our roundtable discussion. And sadly, one of our regular co-hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald, is ill today, so she's not going to be able to join us. If you're listening, Mildred, get well soon. But I've asked our guest today, Sarah Astarte, to sit in as a guest panelist on the round table to help us discuss our topic and not make Deb be the only female voice on the panel. So hopefully you'll enjoy that. And later in the show, towards the end of the show, as normal, we will have our segment for calling in and receiving on-air readings. So you're welcome to do that. You can either Skype in from the show page, or you can call in at 646-716-5510. And I'll just remind you that you can always find information about Firefly Willows Live on Facebook at facebook.com/fireflywillows or on the web at fireflywillows.com/live. And the shows are always archived and can be listened to anytime after the live broadcast here on Blog Talk Radio, as well as they are available at fireflywillows.com/live, or they are available as podcasts for download on iTunes. So you can listen to them anytime afterwards. So I think with that, we will go ahead and start to jump into our roundtable discussion for today. And first, I'll bring in our regular co-hosts, John and Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
Hi-C.
Welcome to the show.
By the way, I think what Mildred has done today is unforgivable.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that we were thinking of, you know, bumping her from all the future roundtables as a result, but now that it's out there.
Well, I'm very happy that Sarah decided that she was able to sit in, and I'm not the only female voice on the panel this morning.
Exactly. And I know Sarah does a lot of goddess work, so I thought, you know, we might as well have two goddesses rather than just one.
You're so sweet.
So, speaking of Sarah, I think I will go ahead and bring her in as well. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for jumping in at the last minute to do this.
It's my pleasure. I think the goddess wanted more representation today, so I'm not going to deny her that.
Well, I think that she has two very capable representatives.
Absolutely.
So our topic today is one that probably many people have given, well, thought to or at least given lip service to, but I wonder how many times we talk about it or say we've done it, yet haven't truly been able to do it. And that topic is forgiveness. So I'm going to ask not only the panelists here, but also everyone listening to think about some of these questions. And with the panelists, we want to get some thoughts. If you're in the chat room, feel free to share some of your thoughts, or you can go to our Facebook page as well to continue the discussion and offer what your thoughts are regarding forgiveness. So just to kind of give you something to jump off of, some questions I want you to think about are, one, what is forgiveness? And what is the difference between true forgiveness versus intellectual forgiveness? When we've said we've forgiven someone, but we continue to talk about it all the time and rehash it when we're talking to other people, is that really true forgiveness, or have we simply given it lip service or simply forgiven in our head, but not really forgiven both ourselves nor gone through whatever the feelings and emotions are that need to be processed and healed for us to truly forgive? What does forgiveness feel like to you? In your body, in your heart, energetically, when you've experienced true forgiveness, and that's both when you have forgiven someone as well as when you've been forgiven, what does that feel like for you? And is it possible to forgive and forget? And really, and should we? So those are just some questions to start off with. And I will ask what some of you panelists have to say about that. John?
Oh, my goodness. This is a heck of a topic. I think forgiveness for me feels like, in the act of forgiving is, I experience it, I know it's done when there's no charge on the experience anymore. It doesn't mean that the experience, the recollecting the experience of being hurt, isn't painful still. I mean, it can still be painful, but the pain is usually, the pain is very much dramatically reduced, and the suffering is gone, and the blame is gone. And that doesn't mean that the person who, you know, who caused me pain, you know, it doesn't mean that I don't still attribute to that person the nature of the pain that I experienced, because the circumstance is still real in me. It's not like the experience disappears. It's just that the experience is now integrated, and it's no longer something that I have fear around, or seek to discharge discomfort around. I understand it as part of my experience, and I accept it, and I don't carry blame or any kind of charge on it anymore. And that is not intellectual forgiveness, because intellectual forgiveness, it is cheap relative to that full integration of that process. So that's kind of what it feels like for me when I'm forgiving. Being forgiven, on the other hand, that's still a work in progress for me.
Well, is that because you feel like there are people who have not forgiven you, or is that because you have trouble asking or saying you're sorry and asking for forgiveness, or because you still hold yourself in blame or judgment even when someone else has forgiven you?
Yeah, I hold myself in judgment. Forgiving myself is really what it comes, you know, where the challenge exists, because it But I have this. I've been, you know, contemplating the nature of heaven and hell, and you know, all of the metaphysical stuff that comes along with doing the things that we do. And it dawned on me that the reason you the nature of hell, the reason you don't enter the kingdom of heaven when you die, so to speak, and you quote unquote go to hell, is because when you die, you realize how much harm you've caused to those around you. And if you can't forgive yourself, that's hell. In order to go to heaven, you have to be able to forgive yourself. And that's not like a rule, right? It's not like, oh, God won't let you in unless you forgive yourself. It's you won't go until you forgive yourself. And so that's why, frankly, personally, that's one of the big reasons why I'm trying to figure this out. Because I would like to be able to go to heaven when I die. but it's the self, the burden that I carry in forgiving myself that seems to be the hardest one for me to set down.
Sarah, do you have any thoughts around any of these particular questions?
Oh, absolutely. It's something I've actually spent time studying. And when I was a student in school, I took a course called Forgive for Good. One of my professors, Frederick Luskin, wrote a book with the same name. And he raised some interesting questions. And thinking about how that shows up for me, not just in theory but in practice, the way I conceptualize forgiveness is that it's not condoning necessarily what was done where the person feels hurt, but it is letting it go so that the person doesn't harbor bitterness. They're not still carrying the pain of what happened. And that's not an easy thing to do. It takes time. In fact, I would say people typically will have a grieving process around what it was where they feel wronged or hurt that they should need to forgive someone. There'll be anger, there'll be sadness. And one can hope they eventually come to a place where they can say, okay, you know, this is what happened. And even if they do not condone the act itself, they can at least say, you know what, I don't want to, as John was alluding to, suffer anymore. You know, I don't want to continue carrying this poison inside of me, you know. It's choosing to let go of the pain, and that's what I see forgiveness is that I or someone chooses to not feel the pain of something anymore. And they may not get the validation they want from someone else. They may not get the apology they want. But again, they're saying, you know, this is me taking charge of my own healing and choosing to let go of something that's doing me harm that I'm carrying around internally. So it can take some time and some work, but, you know, people choosing to let go of something is what I see forgiveness as. And the question you asked about what that feels like in your body, to me it feels like an exhalation, literally breathing out, letting go, and saying, I choose to not carry this anymore. And then deeply breathing in and bringing in fresh air and believing that that is what I'm going to breathe in, healthy fresh air, to nurture myself. I'm no longer carrying around something that hurts me. I choose to bring in something that nurtures me. So should someone face a situation or person from which they believe they were done harm, that they felt hurt by, it would be a test to see if they've truly let go. You know, would they get angry again? Would they be defensive? Would they run away to protect themselves? Or would they be able to be in the same space and not be bothered? It's a very challenging position to be in. And when you asked about forgiving and forgetting, it's a nice idea, but honestly, I don't think it's wise to forget because it's part of our learning. You know, when we feel hurt by someone, we can learn, you know, is this someone healthy for me to be in relationship with? will I get hurt again or not? So it's something to think about, you know, just for future reference. You know, if I find myself in this situation, is it wise for me to be in this position? If I choose to be in relationship with this person, am I putting myself in a position to get hurt again? So it's some important questions to ask, which we again come back to our own self-awareness and self-care. And, you know, I think it'd be lovely if we could forget past wrongs that we have done or done to others. And, you know, to live without that knowledge would be very blissful. But unless we have dementia, we'll miss out on the learning that hopefully will come with those experiences.
And I think that speaks to something I read recently that said, true forgiveness is allowing yourself to experience and go through all of the emotions and feelings that process entails, rather than just saying you forgive someone and walking away, but not having allowed yourself to feel everything that experience has to bring you. And like you were talking about, it can be a grieving process, or it can take time and it takes work. And most people don't want to put that in. They want to just say, oh, okay, fine, I forgive you, and then they move on. And yet they really have just kind of boxed up and buried and carry around with them the grudge or the resentment that then can surface later. And that's where I think not forgetting is important in a sense, because on the one hand, forgetting is you no longer hold the grudge against the person, so you don't kind of keep bringing it up or keep treating them as the person that wronged you or whatever, if you're still going to be around them. But it also, not forgetting says, I can remember what it felt like when this kind of thing was happening, and therefore if I start to feel that again, I already have that experience and can identify it more quickly or more immediately to not let the same situation happen again, which I think is probably what triggers a lot of repetition of patterns and cycles in people's lives, is they either haven't learned or they don't pay attention to what that felt like before because they've forgotten, or at least given themselves, you know, convenient amnesia. And because they don't want to be in the difficult feelings that, you know, people don't want to have to sit with or deal with the difficult emotions and experiences. So the quicker they can like put them behind them or not deal with them, the better. And that's why I think,
when you're saying that, I'm registering that forgetting is an imperfect form of forgiving. It's an incomplete form of forgiving.
Yeah, incomplete is a good way to
put it. Because what you were highlighting there is that I'd rather forget than feel everything I need to feel in order to forgive.
Right. Deb, do you have any thoughts around this topic?
Well, yes. This topic is something of a gray area for me. I discovered as we talked about it and decided that this would be the topic for your roundtable this week. As John and Sarah were speaking, the words that came to me first and foremost were release, when talking about what one feels when forgiving a wrong or an instance or an individual, and acceptance as the other word that came to me, I think more in the form of how one forgives oneself, accepting that we're not perfect beings and we occasionally act imperfectly. We hurt others. We do things that hurt ourselves. Important to accept that is the case. We do that, and that is part of who we are. That's not an excuse, but we have to accept that is part of being human. And in order to then work through and feel those feelings and then ultimately release those feelings, we have to first accept that's part of what we are and who we are. And I agree very strongly with what Sarah said about it's not so much the goal of forgetting a wrong that we have done others or that we feel that has been done to us, because we don't learn. We put ourselves in jeopardy as individuals and as a society if we simply forget past transgressions. But again, as you said, I don't believe that the goal of remembering is to constantly hold someone's foot to the fire or to bring up that sense of outrage or betrayal or hurt that happened originally. It's just a matter of learning and part of the acceptance of the human condition. So the question of do we, as an individual, do I actually really forgive or do I intellectually forgive? That's where the grayness comes in. I'm not 100% sure. I think there are moments when, yes, I have forgiven an individual wholly and completely or myself. But there are other things that I probably still hold on to. And I'm not sure that the anger and resentment and or initial feelings are there so much as the remembering part is there that's very, very, very strong. And I haven't quite gotten to the point of truly processing and allowing the remembering to simply be a lesson learned as opposed to a shield that one must keep vigilance against. So they're kind of shades of gray, you know, how deep have I gone and where am I standing in this particular scenario?
Yeah, you know, something, Deb, that you said and that Sarah said and you kind of alluded to about not forgetting, excuse me, because if you forget, then you potentially put yourself in a place where the same thing can happen again. And I think there's an important subtlety here that I want to tease out, and that is that allowing yourself to be vulnerable is actually okay as long as you do it consciously. And so I agree that forgetting is perhaps the wrong frame of reference to apply here, because you don't really want to forget. You want to be aware that the possibility for that pain or that hurt exists because you're allowing yourself to be in a situation where it could happen. But to do so consciously, to consciously allow yourself to be vulnerable again, allows you to reclaim the totality of the capacity that exists in relationship with other people. If you don't ever forget and use that as an excuse or as a reason, or excuse is the wrong word, use it as a reason to not allow yourself to be vulnerable again, then I think that too is a burden that interferes with your completeness and your complete healing.
And I think that speaks to something as we bring this roundtable to a close. I decided while you were talking to just pull a quick card from the tarot and ask the question, what is forgiveness? And the strength card came up.
Yay!
And, nice.
And I think that really speaks to asking for forgiveness as well as forgiving someone else is not a sign of weakness. And it's actually a sign of strength to be able to do that. And it's more about being able to have the strength to overcome our inner demons, whether it's fear of what someone will say or how they will judge us or if they will reject us, or the anger or resentment that we may feel towards someone that gets in the way of us being able to move towards forgiveness. But instead of feeling weak because we have to ask for forgiveness, or feeling as if somebody else won, quote unquote, because that we're forgiving them, which in our head we're thinking means we're letting them off the hook for what they did in some way or excusing what they did. If we can let go of all of that and simply have the strength to forgive or ask for forgiveness, then I think we would find ourselves moving into a much happier place. And like Sarah said, a place where we can breathe freely and fully rather than feeling as if we're kind of stopped up or strangled when we try to breathe, because all of that stuff is still getting in the way and tightening its grip on us every time we think about that situation or that person or whatever. So thank you to everyone for having offered your thoughts on this, and especially to Sarah for having jumped in here at the last minute to be our little guest panelist. Well, not little, good heavens, that sounds horrible, doesn't it? But she is. I just mean she's shorter than me.
I can bounce with the best of them.
And Mildred Lynn, whatever we said at the beginning, forget it all. We forgive you for having been sick and missing our round table. We forgive you. So thank you, everyone, for joining us for this portion of the show. Deb and John.
Thanks, Icy.
And Sarah. And stay tuned, because Sarah, and I just want to let people know that if you wanted to find out more about Sarah, she will be back in the show for us to have a bit of a more in-depth conversation. And if you want to go see a little more about her before that, you can look on her website at innerfirespiritguide.com. And coming up, you'll hear throughout the show some different people offering their thoughts on what it means to be in love. As well as the astrology segment, our monthly astrology segment, and the new segment that we're introducing, which is Living Well with Linda. And if you want to call in for a reading later in the show, feel free to do that. You can Skype in from the show page, or you can call 646-716-5510. And I don't know that I mentioned, I'll also have a little magical moment segment that is very easy to do, but is something that I think you can do on a daily basis, and you may be surprised at how it transforms you if you do it regularly. So stay tuned for all of that.
Wonder why it don't move, trying to get in. Watching people break the rules. Maybe the man in charge doesn't like my face. But then this world's not always good, and nothing's real but love. Nothing's real but love.
My name is Yesha Rabbit, and you can visit me at wayoftherabbit.com. What does it mean to me to be in love? To me, to be in love is to be present. To be in love is the decision to meet someone on their terms, not always on mine. To be in love is to open myself, my heart, my soul, my mind, and my body to another person with the words, "I have made of myself a banquet for you. Come, feast." To be in love is to care and consider what is really needed, even above what is wanted. To be in love is to know when to let go so that you have the joy of return again and again and again. To be in love is to be now, yourself, whole, now, the other person whole, now, just as you are? What does it mean to me to be in love? I'm complete.
This is James Moran with your astrology update for February 2013. So this month we have the Pluto and Uranus square aspect in the sky, which is the long-standing transit that we have actually for this entire decade. That's the 60s energy that has come back, the energy of uprising that we see in the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement and whatever will be the next manifestations of that Pluto-Uranus square as we move through this decade. So that's still there, very much there for this month. Planetary alignments that are more specific to February, we have the during the weekend of this podcast, February 9th and 10th, we have the new moon. In Aquarius, the new moon is when the moon and the sun are in the same place in the sky. That means that the moon, the emotions, and the sun, the will, are aligned. It's kind of a time of planting seeds, and it's a time where the energy in the collective is a bit more geared towards perhaps being at home, being with family, a good way to honor the Aquarius energy is by fiddling with technology, inventing little ways that make things easier for you and for others. The new moon is the time of kind of planting the seeds of will and emotion that later come out during the full moon. So that's new moon in Aquarius, the weekend of February 9th and 10th. A larger transit, which is for the entire month of February and actually beyond, is the Jupiter-Neptune square in the sky. It means Jupiter and Neptune are 90 degrees from each other in the sky, and Jupiter is the archetype of broader horizons, the bigger view, the broader expansive perspective, gives a note of success and blessing. Neptune is the archetype of the ocean, the spiritual, that which has no center, no boundaries. The two together, mutually activating each other, lends a note in the air for the collective of spiritual tendencies, because Jupiter, the broader expanses of Jupiter are involved. It could be travel for spiritual reasons. It could be travel to visit the ocean, since Neptune, the archetype of the ocean, is involved. Can add a note of spiritual success, kind of the view from the spiritual mountaintop. At the beginning of the month, the first half of the month, we have Mars joining that Jupiter-Neptune square in the sky, which gives a note of bravery. Mars, the archetype of the warrior, gives a note of bravery to Jupiter-Neptune. It could be the spiritual bravery, the bravery to jump into a spiritual quest, maybe some type of spiritual ceremony or meditation retreat. It can also be spiritual sport, since Mars is associated with athleticism. Spiritual sports such as yoga, Tai Chi, or maybe water sports, since Neptune, the archetype of the ocean, is involved. The second half of the month, we have very different energy coming in. Mars leaves that alignment, and Venus comes in, timely, with Valentine's Day. Venus is the very different energy of love, beauty, pleasure, art, artistic creation. So when Venus joins Jupiter and Neptune, we have kind of divinely inspired art, or kind of divinely transporting art or fashion, spiritually themed art that is uplifted by the Jupiter archetype for the second half of the month. We also have a touch of spirituality to the area of love and romance, kind of divinely sanctioned love. So wonderful combination there, and very timely with Valentine's coming, and it's most of the second half of February. Here to be navigated by being enjoyed, Venus and Jupiter, Neptune all together like that could be a bit entrancing because of its the sublime and uplifting quality that Neptune and Jupiter give to Venus, the beauty and the attractive principle there to be enjoyed. The way to navigate it is to know that this is a ephemeral manifestation, and Venus will move on and transform into its next incarnation as it moves along through the zodiac. And that's our very exciting update for the month of February. These are the large energies that are in the air with the collective. How it affects us individually depends very much on how these alignments fall on our personal birth chart, on where the stars were when we were born. So if you would like to know where this energy falls in your own personal birth chart, feel free to contact me. I can be emailed at james@jamesmoran.co. That's jamesmoran.co. That's james@jamesmoran.co. I also have a Facebook page now. James Moran, writer, astrologer, yogi. Type that into Facebook and I'll pop up, or type in any variation of those words and I'll pop up. James Moran, writer, astrologer, yogi. I can be contacted that way too. Enjoy this very dynamic and spiritually uplifting month of February, and have fun out there. Thanks. Bye.
Hi, my name is Bill, and I read the tarot. You can reach me if you're interested on Facebook as Bill Tarot. For me, the difference between being in love and the state of love is around allowing a person to be fully who they are and not trying to change them, and maintaining that state of love even when it can sometimes feel challenging. The way that I've come to think of this, and it's actually something I've given thought to as I've reflected on my youth and also on people who have passed away from my life that I loved very much, is that back in the day, I guess you could say, I would get a lot more frustrated with the person that I was in love with because our relationship wasn't living up to this concept that the movies and the media talks about in terms of this idealized sense of love. And when we're able to step back and just maintain this state of love, even during times when your partner is being really challenging and it's not turning out the way that you wanted your idealized relationship to be, for me that's being in the state of love. It's trying to attain the sense of unconditional love that I think might be almost impossible for a human being to fully realize, but the closer that we can move ourselves in that direction and watch somebody that we love do something that irritates us, but for us to experience that with an inner smile that says, you know, that's just one of those things about that person I love. I think that's the difference. And another way I've thought about it is when a person passes away and is no longer in your life at all, and you reflect on those moments that when they were around that got you really riled and angry and upset because of their quirky behaviors, and now you look back on it after they've passed and you with a smile and you think, like, gosh, that's, you know, it's one of the funny things about that person that I really loved. And so if we can experience that sense of honoring who they are when they're alive and maintain that state of love as opposed to getting angry and upset, that's what I think it's all about.
Are you creating your own non-optimal reality? Might your hidden beliefs be hijacking your manifestation machinery? Join shamanist, radio host, and compassionate adventure guide, John Carosella, on a journey to the places where beliefs hide at East West Bookstore in Mountain View on Thursday, February 21st. Identify the great fear we all share. Discover how beliefs can blind us to soul loss. Freeing ourselves from hidden beliefs allows us to heal ourselves and in turn, the world around us. What beliefs are you willing to release in order to be healed? Mark your calendar. Thursday, February 21st at East West Bookstore in Mountain View. It's free. Register at www.eastwest.com/events.
Linda Wiley has been engaged in healing work for over 25 years. She is a certified chef and food therapist, spiritual counselor, and home artist. She has been the owner of a restaurant, a catering company, and has been a co-creator of Whole Food Delis. Linda creates environments that facilitate health and well-being, food that enlivens the body and mind, and spiritual understandings that soothe and nourish the soul by helping one look deeper into themselves, where all change and healing begins. She grows her own food, including savory and medicinal herbs and edible flowers. Each month, Linda shares with us her wisdom and experience working with herbs, food, and flowers in order to help us live in greater harmony with the natural world and to support our well-being in body, mind, and spirit. So please enjoy this month's segment of Living Well with Linda Wiley.
Hi everyone, Linda Wiley here with Living Well with Linda, your monthly guide to well-being in body, mind, and spirit. It's about an alternative approach to life and healing. I like how Hippocrates says it, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. That really covers the feelings and philosophies that I am sharing here with you each month. So first off, I wanted to speak about winter, since that's where we are. And I also feel that to follow the seasonality of life brings harmony and strength to the body, because we're participating with life from where we are in our own local environment. So winter is really a time for going within. It's a time to sit and drink tea by the fire, to read books, to let the body rest. Because if we watch nature, we see that nature is at rest. The trees aren't blooming. Nothing is really growing. It's a time of rest. Animals are hibernating. It's a within time. It's dark. Yes, to look into our own darkness, if you will. But not as it being a negative thing, but to see what's here, to really face ourselves and see what we need to face in order to put on the compost that is going to bring rebirth and regeneration in the spring as we plant our new seeds in our new soil that is clean and free now of the weeds and the constraints that could choke it out. So in winter, if we stay busy, 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 like the program says, that we should always be busy doing, making, happening, we miss the whole thing of what winter is. And it creates stress in the body, mind, and spirit. It doesn't allow the body to do the rest that it needs to be doing. And we're not taking care to build our immune system, to eat the warming herbs and foods that we need to be strong in this time so that we make it through the winter in a healthy way without a lot of sickness and depression. With that understanding, then it could lead us into talking about alternative approaches to deal with the flu this winter and how to go about that. So I would like to speak of six allies from the natural world that can help support us during the winter flu season. And they would be elderberry, golden seal, colloidal silver, a honey lemon ginger jelly-like that we can add cinnamon to, astragalus, and vitamin D3. Now, mostly I like tinctures because it seems to me that they work most effectively and directly and immediately, and it's easier for the body to assimilate and digest. And so with that, so elderberry and golden seal, I kind of class together in some ways, as with most of these things we're talking about. They're antiviral, antibacterial. They fight both of those things. Golden seal soothes the mucous membranes and just allows things to flow through more easily and keeps things moist and moving. And golden seal is also an antibiotic. Colloidal silver is an incredible healing tool that is also antibacterial and antiviral. It helps with infections inside and out of the body. It has been shown to kill hundreds of strains of both bacteria and viruses. So it is an incredible tool, and it can be made at home. It's cheap, economical, easy to make, and very effective. It's great for burns and skin rashes and all kinds of things too. It's just not limited to internal use. Astragalus is an incredible Chinese herb that's been used since ever with these Chinese healing tools. It is a very warming herb, which is great for winter because it warms our internal organs that need to stay warm to function properly in the winter. If we're all cold and damp out here, matching the outer cold, damp weather, we're not going to function right. So we need the balance of the warm inside to keep us strong and healthy. Astragalus is also anti-inflammatory, and inflammation is actually the cause. Chronic inflammation is the cause of most disease. So it is also full of antioxidants, and in that way it protects and supports the immune system, and that it helps to prevent colds and upper respiratory diseases. It really strengthens and boosts the immune system. And vitamin D3 is like the star of the block these days. It heals everything. It's good for everything. And why wouldn't it be? Sun is the gift of this planet. It's why we have life. Sun is absolutely necessary to the health and well-being of our body, and we should try and get as much of it as we can. Sunscreen prevents the body from making vitamin D3, so I recommend against that. And we should try and get as much sun as we can, even in the winter. If it comes out and you're available to be in it, it's good to be in it. It is not available in a tincture form. It's usually in a capsule, or it does come in a liquid. I've heard a little dropper full, but I don't know that you would actually call it a tincture. It's just a liquid form of it. So I haven't experienced that, but what I do use is from Source Natural, the vitamin D3, and it's 2000 IU. And I think that's like what they say is the minimum that we should be taking. And when you're sick, perhaps you want to up it. And most people, interestingly enough, or not so really, are vitamin D deficient because we're not out in the sun. We live in buildings and fluorescent lighting, and so we're not getting the amount of sun that we need for optimal health. So boosting our vitamin D levels in the winter can be a very beneficial thing in helping us stay healthy during the winter months. Most of my herbs that I suggest, like the elderberry and the golden seal, the astragalus, those are all tinctures. I really like tinctures. I feel that tinctures are assimilated in the blood easily. They're directly assimilated. You don't have to digest anything. I just feel it's a very simple, easy way. You can take your bottle with you to work, on the bus, wherever it is, you have it, it's easy. Companies that I like are Herb Farm and Gaia Herbs. I trust their integrity. I've used them for a long time. I've dealt with them personally. I think they're really fine companies. I have a honey lemon ginger jelly that you can make. It's very easy. Honey is an incredible antibacterial. It's antifungal. It has full of enzymes and all kinds of living, wonderful things in there that really support the body. The honey coats the throat, soothes the intestines, helps digestion. It's just incredible. And ginger warms and soothes and helps digestion and nausea. It also helps to fight infection, and it's also anti-inflammatory. So all the herbs that help with the inflammation process are really wonderful and should be considered. As for the lemon, it's an incredible fruit that helps cleanse the blood and alkalinize the body. The flavonoids, along with vitamin C, provide a punch against infection. It balances the body chemistry, helps keep the bowel and liver clean, and all the minerals that it has adds to the proper functioning of the body. So it's also one of those incredible fruits to use often. So as for this honey, lemon, and ginger compote, I guess you could call it in a way, you take a pint jar, you know, a canning jar, and you slice two lemons, not really thin, but not fat, nice slices. You put them into the jar with about a finger's length of ginger root cut into rounds, and then you pour the honey on top. You make sure that the honey gets down in and around the lemons and the ginger, and it gets packed in there. You can just let it rest like that a little bit, making sure that the honey settles down into it. Once that's happened, you put it in the refrigerator with a cover, you know, the lid on it, and let it sit maybe for a few days, I would say, till the flavors and all those healing goodnesses get mingled in there. And then you just take it as needed, a nice heaping teaspoon in a cup of hot water, and you sit by the fire and sip it, and it's very soothing to the throat and the stomach, and it's a lovely way to take care of yourself in the winter. One of the other spices that I'd like to talk about is cinnamon. Cinnamon is an antioxidant. It's antimicrobial. It stabilizes our sugar, and it breaks up congestion. So cinnamon is actually a really amazing healing spice, as many of our spices are. And what I would like to suggest is that you can add a bit of cinnamon to your taste to the honey, lemon, ginger mixture that we've made and is in the refrigerator. Just add a little bit of cinnamon to that, and it will boost, I feel, the healing power. It will help bring it all together. Thank you for joining me today for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley, and if you would like to chat further with questions or comments or consultations, you may contact me at linda@prestia.com. Have a great day.
My name is Sarah Astarte. I'm an interfaith chaplain and spiritual guide. I work in hospice care, and I also have my own private practice as a spiritual guide and counselor. And you can find out more information about me at www.innerfirespiritguide.com. And in response to the question of what it feels like to be in love, I'd like to offer some thoughts. Having a background in psychology, I've learned that we have chemicals in the brain that seem to come up when we find ourselves in a state of infatuation. And I say it like that on purpose because it feels so good. I'm getting excited just talking about it, just remembering what it's like. Because we find ourselves seeing the world through rosier colored glasses, and everything is much more exciting. We walk around with a huge grin on our face, looking ridiculous, as if we've just done something naughty, and we might have. The chemistry in the brain at this time is the same kind of chemistry, interestingly, as having an acute psychotic episode. We need less sleep. We have a lot of energy. We have a lot of creative energy that's coursing through us. And we're full of ideas and full of excitement. And it's similar to when people are working on a creative project. People who are artists and writers and dancers often have extended periods of time where they're working on something, composing something, choreographing something, and they're so engrossed in the process that they don't realize what time it is, they don't need as much sleep, they're not eating as much. This energy that's coursing through them is basically taking over. And that's often what love feels like. We think about it when we wake up. It's the last thing we think about when we fall asleep. We can't wait to see and feel and be near the source of our infatuation. And it's a very delicious feeling. And interestingly, our senses are heightened as well. So taste, touch, smell, sight, everything just brings in more stimulation for us. And we're very easily excited. And people may look at us funny, wondering why we're so damn happy. When I'm in this position, I certainly like to brag about what it is that's making me so happy. I end up telling the grocer, the bank teller, and anyone else who will hear me. Because we're so freaking happy and excited, even if it's just what we would classify as a small crush or something as big as finding the person we believe we're going to commit ourselves to for a very long time. Either way, for whatever shelf life, infatuation, and the state of love feels like, it's really amazing and delicious.
Revolutionary guest this month is Sarah Astarte, PhD. Sarah is a transpersonal psychologist whose practice includes spiritual guidance, creative expression, dream interpretation, channeling, and shamanic healing techniques. Sarah will be talking with us about her book, The Lover Within, exploring the relationship between body image in adult women and archetypes of the lover, as well as the extensive research she has done on the topic of love, sexuality, and body image. So please help me in welcoming to the show today, Sarah Astarte. And welcome back to the show, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
And I just want to remind people listening that you can find more information about Sarah at her website,
and that is innerfirespiritguide.com. How goes your Sunday?
Beautifully so far.
Excellent. I'm curious about what brought you or drew you into the particular focus that you decided to take with your work and the things that you studied and with love and sexuality and body image and those kind of things. Can you just give a little background as to what drew you to those areas and why you decided to focus on them?
Sure. Well, I followed my intuition on which graduate school and graduate program to go to. And I had always been attracted to spirituality, and I felt very called to go to a non-traditional psychology program. So when I toured my graduate school, I just knew where I belonged. I went to what is now called Sophia University. And spiritual guidance felt like the right program. And I ended up doing creative expression as well, which is similar to art therapy. Excuse me. So when I entered the program and we had our very first creative expression seminar, we were required to do something artistic. And I did not have a lot of faith in my abilities at the time, but being in the class, I started working on projects. And these projects were about my own journey and myself. And I started taking photographs of my body. Actually, I took a little fun favorite camera to the dressing room of Victoria's Secret one afternoon. I thought, you know, I need to finish this role. So my friend and I at the time just decided to be silly and take pictures of ourselves and various things that we found at the store. And my photographs turned out really beautifully. And I thought, you know, most of my life I have felt unattractive. I believed I was not anything interesting to look at. And I thought the only person who would ever fall in love with me would be a long-standing dorky friend of mine who finally just gave it. But, you know, when I looked at these photographs and I took them with me to class because we had to present our portfolios at the end of the quarter, I only showed those particular photos to a few select people, but they commented on how stunning I looked and how I looked like a natural. And I started to look at myself in a new way. And this old self-image of being unattractive and having a body type that was not anything appealing. And there's a lot of these negative messages that I had, especially being a woman of color and not finding representation for women that look like me in mass media very much, unless she's someone in a supporting role or the fat girl that gets made fun of or something like that. It was hugely validating to have friends and classmates look at me differently and treat me like I was a beautiful, attractive woman. I had a lot of male classmates, and getting that kind of attention was shocking at first, but very pleasurable later on. So just in continuing to work on myself, and I started working with a spiritual guide, and I was young, I was in my early 20s at the time, so it was a very influential time for me. I did a lot of self-work, and I consciously chose to work on my own body image and tell myself, I am a worthwhile person, I'm an intelligent person, I'm an attractive person, and you know what, I'm sure there's other women out there that also have been given negative messages, and we're not told they were beautiful growing up. And, you know, no matter what they may look like, let alone what kind of energy they have, they may not believe very good things about themselves. In fact, I bet most women feel that way. So I started doing research on it. And, in fact, I also found a good amount of information on males. But that's something that we may want to talk about another time, because, sadly, it's not given a lot of attention. Male body image people just kind of brush aside It's something that's underreported, so it's not that it's not a big deal as well. But anyway, even to generalize, people in general, I think, you know, we are spoon-fed images of what is supposed to be attractive and beautiful, and it's very unrealistic. What we see in the media of what is attractive is actually only what 2% of people in the U.S. look like. And for the 98% of us who do not look like that, do we just beat ourselves up and feel bad, or do we buy into all the useless diet products and go through expensive surgeries to match this unrealistic ideal? Well, most of us can't even afford to do that, so no. So I decided I wanted to do something to help people learn to love themselves just as they are. I've met people who have amazing energy and beautiful spirit and are incredibly magnetic and attractive, and it really is about how they choose to carry themselves and how confident they are and how well they believe in themselves. So I've worked on myself to try to be at that level and have more self-acceptance and increase my own self-esteem, not because I changed the way I look, but because I changed the way I looked at myself. And I created a treatment plan, if you will, to help others do the same. And this treatment plan involves doing creative projects, doing a body map, you know, drawing a map of your own body and taking a very good look at yourself and facing what you have and what you don't have, and learning to accept and appreciate what you do have. And I had people dance just to be in their own body and enjoy it and express themselves, and we played dress up one day. I brought different clothes and accessories and just let people, you know, have freedom to be whoever they wanted to be. And it was very interesting parts of people that came out that they were not even aware that they had. They got to step out of their mundane routine and really have a lot of fun and letting themselves be free. So we did projects like that for about a month, and it was all in my book. All of my participants had increased self-acceptance and increased self-esteem. And a few of them, in fact, had shifts in their gender identity, significant shifts. But they really got to unleash parts of themselves and grow in ways they didn't even imagine, which was amazing. And I was so happy to be part of that process. And a number of them also reported afterward that they ended up taking better care of themselves. And it's not like they consciously left and decided to go on a diet plan or start a new exercise routine. They actually, because they had increased self-esteem and more self-love, they just had this conscious thought, you know, I want to take better care of myself. And they ended up doing it without really planning it. And they would just eat better and went out more and had a lot more confidence socially as well. So I think the key is not trying to find another diet book. I think the key is really learning to love and appreciate ourselves just as we are. And it's something that we have to work at pretty much on a daily basis. I can certainly wake up and, you know, be like, oh, look at me, look at my thighs. And then I will reframe it and say, you know what? No one's ever complained about these thighs, okay? I love these thighs, hey, they're strong, they get me where I need to go. And actually, they look really good in most pants. So, you know, it's just acknowledging that, yes, I'm human. I can have self-deprecating thoughts even now, and that's okay. And I can just enjoy what I have and appreciate it. And in fact, I actually just had my birthday on Friday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And I'm entering my mid-30s. And I made a list of things that I have and that I don't have. And amongst the things that I don't have that I'm happy about are sagging body parts and wrinkles. And so I thought, you know, I'm getting older. I don't have the same bladder control I used to. And, you know, some parts of me will get thicker, some parts might get thinner. And I thought, well, I'm still doing really great for the body that I have, and I just need to continue to take good care of it. And I know that I am a very flamboyant, attractive person, and it really has mostly to do with what kind of energy that I'm carrying and how I choose to carry myself. So it feels good. And I've had a number of clients come in who have actively wanted to work on their body image. They've wanted to hear their sexuality. A lot of people I've had come in suffered from trauma, sexual abuse, physical abuse, even just verbal abuse, you know, being demeaned and degraded, put down by a lover or by family members, or just feeling unseen and unappreciated by society in general because they don't have the type of looks that in this cultural context are deemed as attractive. This cultural context meaning mainstream American culture, because we have a lot of cultures in this country, and even perhaps going into a different neighborhood and being treated differently just based on what you look definitely happens as well. So a lot of my clients have come in with those issues, and I've done different body image exercises with them, the body mapping exercise, and, you know, assign them homework of go home, slowly, sensually put lotion on yourself, get to know your own body, enjoy what you have, learn to love it, you know, just seeing that the self-care is going to sink in on multiple levels just from doing an act of kindness for yourself. So it's been really great work. I've watched my clients, even if I work with them for a short period of time, have a pretty good shift in their self-image. And again, interestingly, I see that people do take better care of themselves as their self-esteem goes up. You know, in our mainstream culture, we're sold a lot of these ideas about beauty that are built on insecurity, that you're not going to look good unless you use this beauty product. You're not going to look good until you weigh this much. And people will purchase those things or engage in those behaviors, some of which are pretty unhealthy, to you know, out of fear to look and conform to the standard of beauty that they think they're supposed to in order to get the acceptance that they want. And I've seen people, you know, go from diet to diet and fail. And even if, interestingly, they do fit into the beauty ideal that we have, that doesn't necessarily mean that they feel good about themselves. They end up spending a lot of time beating themselves up. They're constantly insecure. They're constantly comparing themselves with everyone else in the room. And it's hell on earth to live like that, feeling so bad about yourself all the time. So, you know, again, seeing my clients just take better care of themselves, not out of fear, but out of self-acceptance and self-love and wanting to take care of themselves, wanting to feel good, and realizing that they have more to give in relationship to others because they have a fuller cup. It's a wonderful thing to see, and I have to practice this on myself as well, but it's very, very worthwhile. Our first love, in fact, does need to be ourself.
You mentioned your book, which is called The Lover Within, Exploring the Relationship Between Body Image in Adult Women and Archetypes of the Lover. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could, one, maybe just give a brief rundown of what the archetypes of the lover are, and also maybe if you could just speak to how that book would be beneficial to men as well, or if not, perhaps it's just specifically geared towards women, but if men could also benefit from it.
Okay, so in my book, it basically maps the progress that I have in working with a multicultural group of women that age from about 25 to 40 years old, and it maps their progress as I work with them on their body image and self-esteem. It includes photographs of some very fun ones, especially when they're playing dress-up. And it brings in the archetype of the lover. And what I did with that is I took Jungian psychology, specifically archetypal psychology, and utilized it to work with people. The archetype of a lover, it's the motif of a person, or an energy rather, of the lover, which has to do with sensuality, self-esteem, and self-awareness. And those things go together very, very acutely because, again, to love and be loved, you have to know yourself. You have to be self-aware. You have to be sensual, meaning sensation-oriented. And what I wanted to do was to utilize this kind of energy with my participants so that they could harness it and let this energy, this archetype, emerge from their subconscious into their consciousness. Because I figured if we can help these participants be more self-aware, take a very good look at themselves in the mirror, and I had them sit in front of a mirror every day for several minutes just staring at themselves and really face themselves, their flaws and all, and learn to accept who they see and learn to appreciate themselves just as they are, I knew that they would definitely be in a better place than when I first started working with them. And these ideas, of course, are beneficial for everyone. It has nothing to do with gender. It has everything to do with being human, because all of us have at some point felt unappreciated and unseen. Most of us, 98% of us, do not fit the beauty ideal of this culture, of this country. And all of us can use a little more love. So taking these ideas of facing ourselves, doing some of the exercises described in the book, all of these are very helpful to help us learn to love and grow within ourselves. And, of course, when we do that, we have so much more to offer the rest of the world.
In the little piece before this, when you were talking about what it means to be in love, you had mentioned kind of that rush or that high, that feeling of deliciousness that comes when especially you're in a state of infatuation or that you have a crush on someone. Can you maybe speak about how people can identify and separate out feelings of infatuation or a crush from the feeling of truly being in love, if that makes sense. Because I think that when people have that rush of the infatuation or crush, a lot of people get a bit addicted to that, and then they struggle when it starts to wear away and a relationship continues into longer term, and then they start to either think the relationship isn't what it used to be, or it's not really working anymore, or we're not really connected the same way, simply because we're not getting that rush anymore. And so I think that that can get in the way of people staying in and being willing to do the work for the long-term relationship because they think they need to have that high or that rush constantly to know that this is who I'm supposed to be with.
Okay, so with infatuation, it does have a limited shelf life. It's typically, if we were to look at the progression of a relationship, be in the beginning stage, when we find ourselves attracted to someone, there are pheromones that we are smelling, we're very excited, we're very stimulated and turned on by what we see, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch. You know, we're listening to love songs all the time. We've got a little bounce in our step. You know, just feeling wonderful. And it is very juicy. It's a natural high. And for some people, it certainly can become an addiction. They may, you know, just love the feeling of being in love. The person they love may be a complete schmuck. And they realize that sooner or later, hopefully, but it's not really that person they were after. It was how it felt to be infatuated, that they wanted. And, you know, so typically relationships will have that in the first few months. And some people are lucky enough to keep it going longer. Good for them. So maybe they just listen to Sade for extended periods of time. But when that starts to fade, we get to see our partner for who they really are. We see them as a real person. Now, at this stage, if I were to generalize, you know, if I want to use a very stereotypical timeline, I would say maybe 6 months to a year, where a friend of mine, she likes to say, the warts come out, where you stop looking at that person as perfect and wonderful and idealized, and you start to see them as actual person who has flaws, who has, you know, bad breath when they wake up in the morning, and, you know, they do obnoxious little things that annoy you sometimes, and you get to see, oh, this is who the person really is. And so there's a couple of choices we can make at that point. We can choose to move on to someone new, especially if we want to just keep the rush of infatuation going, or we can choose to stay in relationship and engage with that person and get to know them as the everyday human being that they are and see how it goes. You know, couples may find themselves in a more conflict situation at this point, but they can also choose to commit to working things out and, you know, really getting to know each other. You know, when the contact high is not as stimulating, oh, it's you again. Well, you know what? You may enjoy being around this person. You know, with couples, especially when they choose to be together long term, there are moments where they can have romance and passion and fun. There are other moments that are very mundane. And, you know, I mean, there's things that people have to do in life that are not so exciting. You know, you have to balance your checkbook. You have to do the laundry. Somebody has to take out the garbage. That's not a moment, typically, where you have some, you know, sonata playing in your head, saying, hey, baby, you know. But you can choose to still be in relationship and get through those more mundane, monotonous moments, because what you have with that person may really be worthwhile.
And I just want to say that even a mundane thing like doing laundry, a boa makes everything more fun. So if you just put on a boa when you do laundry, it'll actually suddenly be much more exciting and glamorous. boas always help to take away the mundane. So in your work with clients and that kind of thing, and I think what you were just talking about really speaks to the theme of the show of being in love, what do you feel like you have perhaps observed as being some of the more difficult aspects regarding love that people are challenged by or struggle with? And it may be a suggestion or two on, if people are struggling or challenged by those, what they can do to work through them or to overcome them.
Well, one thing I've seen that's true for pretty much everyone is managing conflict and how to communicate something, you know, and people may be trying to communicate with each other and are not able to do it very effectively. And if they have different ideas about how to do things, it can often escalate into a conflict. And so something I can never emphasize enough is learning how to communicate with each other. And this is not something that is only something important in an intimate relationship. It's important across the board with family members, with friends, and with work colleagues, you know, because if we want to keep our job, if we want to be able to support ourselves, we have to know how to communicate well and effectively, even when we disagree with someone. So something I like to recommend to people is to look into learning how to communicate nonviolently. Use NVC, nonviolent communication. You can get your point across. You can be present and listen to the other person. Hopefully have them be listening to you. And try to work together to figure things out, to find solutions, and, you know, things like that. With couples, you know, finding a schedule that works for everyone can be challenging, splitting responsibilities, things like that. Some of the main things that couples fight about in the U.S., the first thing is money. Intimacy becomes an issue. When people are busy and working hard or not communicating well with each other, of course intimacy is going to suffer. So being devoted to learning how to communicate well, having a communication style that is effective is very, very important. Another thing that I have seen with a lot of the clients I've had, I have a number of clients that are women that are middle-aged, and they're suffering from empty nest syndrome. And so they've come in to see me because they're trying to figure out what they want to do with the rest of their lives. And a lot of them feel estranged from their partner. They have been in a routine, a lifestyle of raising children, and when the children are gone, they are not quite sure what to do. And so they have to get to know their partners all over again. And I think that's why, you know, a number of couples will split at that stage. And these are couples that have been together for a long time, for a few decades perhaps. And they're at a different phase of their life now, and they're not necessarily sure where to go and if the person they're with is the person they really want to continue being with. And sometimes it's really because they do need to get to know this person all over again. The growth has happened, change has happened, and their lifestyle has changed now that they're at a different phase. So it speaks to what relationships can look like long-term, because I'm sure all of us have gone through infatuations and juicy romances and such, but a committed relationship is a whole different creature, really. It involves infatuation, it involves passion. Hopefully passion can still be present here and there, not just, you know, on somebody's birthday. But, you know, trying to keep passion alive in a long-term relationship can take some effort. And staying in love with someone and staying committed to someone is hard work. That's what I would say a real relationship is, not just, you know, one cheesy romance after another. We can feel romantic by watching a chick flick, which is why they're so popular. But, you know, being devoted to a person, being devoted to being committed to someone is a tough job.
And I think something you said there about, especially like, say, the women with the empty nest syndrome, but I think this applies more broadly to relationships in general, is the longer people are in a relationship, what I have observed is there's a tendency for people to fall into seeing their partner in kind of a box or as a particular role that they've gotten used to them playing or how they've gotten used to seeing them. So like with the woman with the empty nest syndrome, she may have been seen by her partner as mother. And now that that role is really not the primary focus for that person, the other person still isn't able to adjust or allow them to be something else. And so, well, of course, the person, say the woman that you're talking about, has to go through her own process of reconnecting and rediscovering herself and all of that. I think it also is important for the partner to be on a regular basis, not just if there's some dramatic shift in the lifestyle, like where the kids have now moved out or something, but just on a regular basis, be willing to look at their partner and see them for who they are and who they've become, rather than still just operating by looking at them as who they've known them to be and only kind of seeing them in that label or that box.
Right, right. And when the pattern shifts, it is challenging because we're in the habit of treating someone a certain way, seeing them as a certain person. And when that changes, there's typically going to be resistance, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible. You know, it can still be worked on. And what I like to recommend to people is to make an effort to get to know that person again. And it may require dating all over again, which could actually be fun. You know, planning dates with the partner where they're free of, you know, the routine things they do during the day or the week, and be able to sit down with them and be in a romantic space and spend time with them. You know, it's like having a little courtship again and just trying to enjoy connecting with someone. My spiritual guide likes to say that relationships are about relating. The basic core of a relationship is relating with someone, understanding them, connecting with them, and hopefully enjoying their company, which is why we fell in love with them in the first place, I should hope. Because, you know, our butt will start to sag eventually, and our body won't work as well, and the beauty will fade, and at least in some perspectives. So what we're left with is a person, a human being, and we'll have to make an effort to see them as they are. Another thing I like to recommend to couples is to find a hobby that they can share, something they can do together. I know a couple that will sign up for things together, like scuba diving class. So, you know, they work during the week and they're busy and everything, but they'll make a point to do something together. And so they did a scuba diving class and both got certified as scuba divers. So they learned a new skill, but overall they were spending time together. They were enjoying being with each other. So little things like that, you know, going to a new restaurant every week, going to a concert, even going to a cheesy movie, you know.
Well, I think
that's wrong.
Right. And I think something that you mentioned about having fun, you know, if people are like at a point and they're like, say they start dating again just to reconnect or whatever. It doesn't have to be all candlelight dinners and deep, intense conversation every time you do that. It's also about just go out and have fun, you know, do something that's just fun for the sake of fun because you're doing it together.
Exactly. It's surprising to me how many times I've heard someone say to me that, you know, they share a bed with someone, but they don't have any real connection with that person. And that sounds so sad to me because, you know, a bed that's, you know, lying next to someone that is, you know, hopefully it's implied that it's the most intimate space you could be in with someone, yet they have no real intimacy. And when I say intimacy, I don't really mean the physical or sexual so much as I mean emotional, is that they don't have a connection with that person. And that's what needs to be worked on. So whatever activities they choose to engage in to help cultivate intimacy, whether it's scuba diving class or candlelight dinner or, you know, a walk outside, you know, or just, you know, being dorky together, laughing while they're making dinner. You know, that happens.
Yeah.
It's just something to help them enjoy being in the same space of, like, reminding themselves, oh, this is why I fell in love with this person. You know, this is the things that I like about them. There's these new things about them. Let me see how that feels. You know, so it's a forever learning process. It's something that doesn't stop. It's something that requires work. And the United States having such a high, unfortunately, divorce rate speaks to how hectic and busy the lifestyle is for people and how much time they choose or choose not to give to their personal life and personal relationships. And how devoted they really feel to relationships. You know, in a typical, you know, cliche wedding, you know, the vows are, you know, for sickness and health till death do us part. And I wonder, you know, how many people sincerely mean it when they say it, or how sincerely they feel about it as the relationship goes on, especially as the romance may start to fizzle a little bit. And how much they really are devoted to the relationship and want to stay. Because we have, you know, more than half of all couples that legally marry, they split up. So being able to really think about that, you know, how seriously do I take these vows? Maybe I should say something different at the altar if I don't mean it this way. you know, relationship will go until I feel unhappy, then I'll leave. Relationship will go, we will reevaluate in 7 years' time, you know, something
right.
like that. As unromantic as that sounds. But, you know, it's being honest with oneself. We have this often false dream that we're going to be with someone forever, like stupid Cinderella. But, you know, is that realistic? You know, maybe just people being honest with themselves. Am I someone who can be monogamous and happy with that long term? Or do I prefer a lifestyle where I have multiple partners? Or am I a serial monogamist? I'm going to be happy with someone typically this much time. In that other amount of time, I might want to look for someone else. Just so they are being honest with themselves and can set themselves up with the life that they want and be honest with any potential partners they have. But yeah, no matter the nature of the relationship, it's going to be effort. And people, I think, should be aware of that going in, that it's not just romance, not just fun and games. It's going to be a concerted effort on part of both people.
And I think that in our society, we've gotten so used to everything being quick and easy, and the more convenient it is, the better. So if it's going to be effort, then I don't really want to deal with that. I'd rather move on to something that's going to be easy again.
Mm.
And then when it stops being easy, I'll move on to the next easy thing or convenience thing rather than being willing to really invest in the effort.
Right. And that's sad often because typically when a couple starts to get to a point where things are not so easy, it's because growth is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the relationship is at a point where it's going to go to the next level, or it will end. You know, perhaps the relationship is getting to a new level of intimacy and depth. Perhaps the relationship is at a point where the two people have to make a decision about what kind of commitment they're going to have, if at all. And that doesn't mean that those points, you know, where things can get tense are points where things have to end. It is a point where they can choose to stay and have their relationship evolve and grow, or they can choose to call it quits and walk away, in which case they'll have to start all over again with somebody else. And, you know, it's something to look at for people, what their pattern of behavior is, if they choose partnerships based on, you know, certain traits and behavior patterns, if they choose to just be with people for a certain amount of time till there's only romance, or if they do choose to be in a relationship with someone to truly be with that person and they truly love that person and can learn to live together. And again, it's work. It's like having a toolbox with tools you can use to fine-tune the relationship, conflict management skills, communication skills, being able to do the dreaded thing called compromise, you know, split responsibilities and, you know, accommodate things you don't always like. It's part of, you know, having a life with someone. And it's not impossible, but it can be done. So I think a lot of relationships end in the U.S. when people are at a point where they can have their relationship evolve and they're struggling or they're scared or they may be in a situation where they have conflict, they don't know how to manage the conflict, they don't have the tools to work on the relationship that could help them get through it.
Amidst the list of specializations that you have, including some we've talked about, like the body image and self-esteem, self-empowerment, and the dream work that you do, you also do a lot of work in the realm of death and dying. But one of the things that's listed is sacred sexuality. And a minute ago, you were talking about intimacy and sex. And I'm wondering if you could just give us an idea of what does it mean when something is called sacred sexuality?
You want to get to the juicy stuff, don't you?
Well, you know.
I'm sure you
we're past the romance stage here. Now it's time to get into the really interesting stuff.
Well, I'm glad you asked. And I hope my mother doesn't blush too deeply when she hears me talk like this.
She's an adult.
So sacred sexuality has to do with engaging in intimacy and holding it as a sacred space, sacred act, sacred relationship. It's not just, engaging in an act of sex. It has to do with being intimate with someone. In fact, it doesn't even have to actually be engaging in a sexual act. It can be something as simple as looking into someone's eyes and trying to really see them. So it has to do with the energy that we use when engaging with someone. And it is what I would like to say is very true intimacy. It can be very intense. Even eye gazing can be very intense. But it's the belief that sexuality is a way to connect deeply with someone, as well as a way to connect with the divine. And the background that I have for this is coming out of spiritual traditions such as Sufism, where God is love, and to be in love and to know love and to love and nurture yourself, in fact, is a way to be one with the divine, as well as other spiritual traditions that have some similar beliefs. And one that is utilized a lot, especially in the Western context, is Tantra. It's a spiritual tradition that comes out of India. And the Western context of it is pretty different. People don't live out the whole lifestyle that Tantric in the old sense would, but it's a practice that's utilized to help deepen intimacy between couples. So engaging in love with someone, not just physically or not even physically, but really just being in a space of choosing to experience love as a force of the divine, that I am love. My spirit is love. I'm a part of the divine. The divine is running through me. And choosing to connect with people in that way, not looking at someone as an object, not looking at someone as just, you know, someone that you can utilize to have a certain physical stimulation, but seeing them as a human being that is a vessel of divine energy as well, that they are also part of God. They're a human being with a spirit that is beautiful, and choosing to engage with someone in that way, with that intention, it's a very different experience. I'm going to quote my own spiritual guide. She said, you know, you take an experience of comparing someone you pick up in a bar to just, you know, have a few hours of physical stimulation with, as opposed to meeting someone who you are truly in love with, and you see the love you have as a beautiful experience, divine love. That's like comparing Pissant beer to a magnum of champagne. Huge difference. So if we were to think about being with someone and truly loving them and appreciating them and having ourselves be seen and appreciated as if we are vessels for the divine, which we are, it's a very, very different approach than walking into a single bar. You know, and I'm not trying to demean the experience of, you know, going to a bar. Just it really has to do with our approach to sexuality, that it's not just about physical stimulation and having certain, you know, experiences happen that we measure the experience by, that I climaxed this many times and this is what it meant. And it's really about loving oneself, being self-aware, and choosing to engage in an act of intimacy, knowing that the divine is part of you and part of the other person, and divine energy is part of the experience. And so it heightens things. It makes things much more intense. It riles all kinds of passion you couldn't imagine you had. And it's very truly beautiful. And I think people need to have a good amount of trust to engage in something like that. I don't think you can just pick up somebody and expect, you know, fireworks of passion and I mean, that can happen, but sometimes alcohol is involved. But, you know, it just having this amazing experience where you would classify it as spiritual. Well, something that might take some work. Hello?
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's a dog. Okay. I'm like, oh, my God, the gods are speaking. What happened?
That's my dog doorbell.
Okay. That's sacred too. Sure.
That's right. She got very stimulated and excited hearing you talk about all of that.
Yeah, maybe the dog was climaxing. That's fantastic. the translation of what the dog said was, "Oh, baby."
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very different. So I've done some workshops on sacred sexuality and how to cultivate it. And it's something that I work with clients for themselves to help them build their own self-knowledge, self-esteem, their own sensuality, as well as with couples. That, you know, it's not just about romance, especially for long-term committed relationships. This builds a type of intimacy that can be solid as bricks, where you have a deep-seated trust of each other. You have deep knowledge of each other. You love that person's spirit. And I don't think there's any stronger form of love than that. And so I would encourage couples that are serious about being together to look into it, that it's a wonderful way to cultivate very strong, very beautiful intimacy. Even when things can get a little mundane and such, a couple, people who've committed to each other, who know each other, they have a trust. They have an understanding. They know each other like no one else. They can finish each other's sentences. They know that person's deep-seated fears. They know what they like to have for dinner. You know, it can be, you know, mundane things as well as very deep things. And that's what true intimacy is. It's deep-seated trust and deep love and acceptance of someone. So, and plus, with the tantric traditions that are taught here, they teach all kinds of fun physical techniques too, which are beneficial to couples. And it, again, it's about cultivating sensuality, you know, knowing how to stimulate your own senses and be very present in the moment. You know, people can engage in an act with each other and they're actually thinking about picking up the dry cleaning.
Right.
Yeah. Like, are we done yet? Well, that's not fun.
Yeah.
But it's like being very present and gazing into someone's eyes and even, you know, touching somebody's fingertip. It can be a highly erotic experience because they're fully present. So it's the stuff of D.H. Lawrence novels. And it's not fiction. It's real. You can have amazing, beautiful, mind-blowing experiences with people, and it can take some work and some learning, but it is very worthwhile.
Yes. Well, obviously, these are topics that have infinite layers and depths that can be discussed for eternity, I would say. But unfortunately, we're going to have to come to a close of the discussion. And mm-hmm. One thing that I do at the end of each conversation is I have a question for you from the previous guest from last month that I would like to get your response to. And then if you can also think about what question you would like to ask next month's guest without knowing who it is or anything like that, just what you would like to ask them and hear them respond to or talk about. So there's that. And then my guest last month was Dr. E, who is a conjure doctor and hoodoo worker down in Southern California. And mm-hmm. his question for you was, what does integrity mean to you?
Oh, I would say integrity has to do with truth. And being authentic, being real, being honest with yourself. People can say all kinds of things and then engage in behaviors that can seem very much the opposite of what they said. So I would say integrity has to be about being in touch with your true self and being honest with yourself about who you are and how you choose to act. So, and being able to communicate that truth to other people, you know, that's a matter of integrity, being honest with yourself and being honest with people around you and saying, this is who I am and this is how I choose to do things. And just being true to your word, you know, like following through on what you say you're going to do, following through on responsibilities you've taken, commitments you've made. That's what I say integrity is, standing up for your truth, for what you believe in. That's integrity.
And what question might you have for next month's guest?
Well, next month is March. And the holiday for the neo-pagan calendar is Ostara, which comes from the name Astarte, actually. And it's about springtime and growth. So I would ask, what is it that the speaker would recommend that we work on in ourselves to cultivate and grow, that perhaps everyone picks something about themselves they wish to have grow and change.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for having joined us here today and also for stepping in on the round table.
Mm-hmm.
And I will remind people that are listening, you can find out more information about Sarah or contact her if you're interested in talking to her about working with her in one of these realms and areas that she deals with. Sarah Astarte, her last name is Astarte, and her website is innerfirespiritguide.com. So thank you very much, Sarah, and have an amazing Sunday.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks again for having me.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support the Wildlife Center of Silicon Valley, a nonprofit rehabilitation, release, and educational facility. Established in 1993, WCSV serves the citizens and wildlife of Santa Clara County communities from Mountain View to Morgan Hill. Through educational programs, the WCSV fosters a positive coexistence between the general public and wildlife, and encourages an interest in and concern for wildlife conservation issues. With approximately 120 dedicated volunteers, WCSV cares for over 4,000 birds and mammals from over 150 species each year. Find them at www.wcsv.org and on their Facebook page, Wildlife Center of Silicon Valley, WCSVN. Donations to support the animals may be made by clicking the Donate Now button at the top right corner of their website. Further information on volunteering and support may be found under How to Help in the menu bar. This tip of the week from the Wildlife Center of Silicon Valley. Spring is in the air. Not feeling it yet? For some animals, like skunks, it's time to find a mate and get a head start on spring. You might notice their smell. Skunk spray is often a side effect of mating. And then you'll know you have a great, free, and natural source of rodent and insect control around your neighborhood. One fun and critical fact to know about skunks is that they are terrible climbers and can easily be blocked out of a fenced yard. If you need advice, just call the Wildlife Center at 408-929-9453. They're happy to help you problem solve. You can also check out www.wcsv.org for more good info on skunk natural history.
I'm Lisa Dale Miller, a mindfulness psychotherapist with a specialty in Buddhist psychology. My website is lisadalemiller.com.
Being in love is a state so many of us have experienced. It arises, it exists, and it inevitably always passes away. Yet all of the great religions, including Buddhism, tell us that our essential nature is beingness, and the essential quality of that beingness is love. It's not a love that comes and goes. It's not a love that is attached to any particular object or person. It's not a love that has anything to do with possessing, wanting, craving, needing. In Buddhism, this love is called compassion. Compassion is a boundless love. And when I say boundless, I truly mean without any restriction, with no barriers, beyond judging of right, wrong, good, or bad. It is the recognition that all sentient beings, no matter what, are equally deserving of love, kindness, respect, and the wish for their ultimate freedom from all suffering. Now, I know that sounds like a pretty tall order. Loving selflessly, openly, and completely, regardless of the circumstances in which we might find ourselves. And this is a very difficult thing to contemplate, especially with respect to relationships, because compassion, especially boundless compassion, is an essential, innate quality of our beingness. It is present in every moment that we are aware. Yet, because we have human minds that suffer, we need to learn how to cultivate this experience of boundless love. So I have some simple steps that I offer the patients that I work with who suffer from all kinds of difficulties in their lives, especially interpersonal difficulty. When we are experiencing difficult feelings about ourselves or about someone else, the first step toward cultivating boundless compassion is the basic recognition of the difficulty. Saying to yourself, "This is a hard moment," is actually very opening, and it is very healing, because we're not blaming ourselves for the difficulty we might be experiencing, nor are we getting lost in blaming others for the distress they may be causing themselves or us. This is a compassionate recognition that all human minds suffer. And this recognition alone opens us and brings clarity, allowing a generosity and a basic kindness to be applied to any moment of pain or joy. The next step is to see oneself free of this suffering, free of obscurations of mind, free of the constriction in the heart. And though that may not be something that we experience in a difficult moment, that is something that we can wish for ourselves to be experiencing in future moments. So I offer this teaching to you, this beautiful practice of cultivating boundless compassion, so that you may open into the beingness that is, in its essence, love. Deep, enduring, beautiful love.
When we're through is how pleased with what we lack. Some things fall apart, but from the ashes new dreams start. All that matters to the heart is how.
And for our magical moment segment this month, I wanted to offer something that is simple to do and is designed to cultivate love in many ways. One is to cultivate self-love so that we are in a greater state of being in love with ourselves. It is also to help cultivate love in a sense of being able to send love out and be in love with everyone and everything around us. And it also is something that can help to attract the kind of love that we want or need into our lives. Whether that's a romantic relationship or simply feeling acknowledged or feeling as if we are recognized and important and loved by the world around us. So this is something that really kind of helps to generate that in all areas. So the things that you would use for this are very simple. One would be rose petals. Two would be some rose water, which is very easy to find. I know that you can get like a bottle of rose water at Whole Foods for like $5.99 from the Edgar Cayce Foundation, actually. A pink candle. A piece of rose quartz, some chocolates, or some other sweet treat that you like. And if you want, you could also have a bottle of rose oil. That isn't necessarily a key ingredient. That's like an optional ingredient that you could have here. So find a space, pick a little space that you can set up as your love altar. And it doesn't have to be a big space. It could just be a little corner of a dresser. It could be a one little end of the mantle over the fireplace or some place that you can set this up, but some place that you can leave up as your altar for love. Scatter the rose petals on the surface and then place the bottle of rose water and in front of that, the pink candle and in front of that, the piece of rose quartz. And in front of that, the chocolates. Each day, come to that space at a time that is convenient for you. And first, spritz the space and yourself with the rose water. Rose is very energetic for helping to draw love in as well as helping us to stay in a state of love. Then light the pink candle. And as you do so, you're going to say something like this. I will offer you a suggestion, but you can certainly say whatever it is that you feel is appropriate or that you would like to say. This is just a guideline, but you're welcome to write your own or adapt or adjust this in any way that you feel is right for you. So as you light the pink candle, say something like, I am love. Love shines forth from within me. I am love. Love flows abundantly to me. I am love. I offer love. I receive love. I am love. You might repeat that 3 times or 4 times or 7 times. And what you're doing there is not only cultivating and drawing and stimulating that energy within yourself, it's also charging that piece of rose quartz with that energy. And you can then take that rose quartz and put it in your pocket and carry it around with you. And it now helps to carry and energize you and your auric field, the space and the energy around you with love as you walk through the world. When you come back to do this again the next day, just place that piece of rose quartz in front of the candle again. Go through this process and then you can take that piece of rose quartz with you. Also, when you finish, eat a piece of the chocolate or the sweet that you have there, because those are also infused with that energy. And by eating that, you're taking in that infused energy of love. If you happen to walk by that little altar space at some point during the day, and especially if you're feeling a little down, a little unloved or whatever, but even if you're just walking by, you can also grab one of the sweets and just eat it, because it's already infused with that energy, and therefore you would be able to take that in and kind of recharge that energy for yourself just by eating that little piece of sweet. The rose oil is also something that you could use or take with you if you wanted to use that and just dab a couple of drops on you. That also is a way of helping to bring that energy to you and carry it around with you. So I offer that to you as something that you can do simply, but will have some potentially very profound effects as you do it regularly. So I encourage you to try that, especially for the course of either a waxing moon, which would be for 14 days from a new moon to full moon, or for the whole cycle of a moon, which would be 28 days from new moon to new moon. Doesn't mean you can't continue after that, of course, but I think that doing it every day for at least the waxing moon cycle or a full moon cycle, you would start to see a big shift and a big difference in yourself, as well as in the world around you, how you're perceiving it, how it's responding to you, and also what is starting to come into your life. So again, the things that you would need for this: rose petals, rose water, a pink candle, a rose quartz, and some chocolates or sweets, and optionally some rose essential oil. I hope that you might try that. If you do, I would love to hear what some of your results or some of the effects are from it. Feel free to offer those either at the Facebook page, which is facebook.com/fireflywillows, and share your experience from doing that.
Hello, I'm Fred. I am a life coach and a massage therapist, and you can find my presence online on Facebook at The Inner Voice. And reflecting on this topic, being in love, two things occurred to me. One is the ability to love yourself, to be in love with yourself, to be in existence with yourself, to be knowledgeable, conscious, aware of yourself. And by extension, the second point, which leads into your ability to be in love with your exterior, the things around you, the people around you, and how that allows you to connect with the greater world and how you contribute to society and help just make the world a better place. And going back to the first point, being in love with yourself, I think that involves an awareness of who you are as a person, what it is that makes you tick, an understanding of yourself, what your needs are, what you're feeling in the moment, honoring those feelings, what it is that is causing you to have those feelings, and how you handle those feelings. What do you do to find your balance? What do you do to find yourself and recognize what it is that you need? The ability of the art and the ability of self-care, taking care of yourself, the ability to love and be in love with yourself. Self-love, it's very important. It's where all healthy forms of love do begin. Going on from that with self-care is the ability to not only be able to take care of yourself, but then be able to extend that self-care and help others and be able to be in a loving relationship, a healthy loving relationship with others, whether that be your pets, your spouse, your family, your siblings, your friends, even your coworkers. and how you exist by being in love with other people is to help encourage them to love themselves. And it's the ability to independently love another person, helping them be the best they can be, but allowing them to and showing them to love themselves, how to take care of themselves. And by being two people or two things involved in a loving relationship, and how that goes and carries forward and ripples out among people and in your community. And those are my thoughts on being in love.
We told you we were expanding. Tune in to the Amethyst Oracle Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. And get ready for two more shows. Starting in February, join us for A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella. On the first and third Tuesdays each month at 8 p.m., John will bring together leaders and explorers in neo-shamanism. Practical and practiced, his guests are not just doing shamanism, they're living it. And don't miss What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday evening of each month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light, in addition to our original Sunday morning Firefly Willows LIVE anchor shows. Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/LIVE. Stop by and check out Heisey's previous programs, or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or John Carosella. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us! Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Revolution. We hope you enjoyed the show. Next week, join John Carosella for Convergence. John talks with Emily Clark, a shining example of the power of enlightened youth, on bringing love no matter what the circumstances. He'll also delve deep into the role of the divine feminine as a source of love, and what embodying and engaging the receptive principle can teach us about love. In our Firefly Willows weekly roundtable, John leads an exploration of the topic, how we experience receiving love. Tune in for that and more next week on Conversions, right here on Firefly Willows LIVE. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE Presents.